This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn. I'm Lee Chui Lin. An accomplished writer, director, choreographer, scholar and playwright, Ahmed Massoud grew up in Palestine and moved to the UK in 2002. He joins me now to share his experience of growing up in the Gaza Strip, a place often described as hell on earth, and how he's working on humanizing the Palestinian conflict for a global audience through his creative pursuits. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You grew up, as mentioned, in Palestine in the Gaza Strip, and you were only 6 years old when the first Intifada started in 1987. What was life like for you before that?
Life was pretty much normal in a way. Normal in the sense that it was under occupation, so soldiers were all around us. We used to see soldiers in big military boots, heavy arms and stuff like that. But it was part of life somehow. You get to learn how to live with it and you avoid the conflict points, etc. But the moment it started, it changed everything, because the first Intifada was pretty much the same as what you would call the Arab Spring right now. So people went out in the streets demonstrating for their rights and throwing stones on military jeeps, etc. So things changed then and changed dramatically. So even colors changed, the colors of daylight, the colors of the sky. There were burning tires, there were smells, there were things that we'd never seen before, tanks on the streets, more shooting and more people being killed and injured. So it was a shift, a complete shift of life altogether.
How did your parents explain to you what was happening? I mean, on the one hand, I guess it's I'm not a parent, but to me, it's a fine line, I would imagine, between you don't want to scare your child, but at the same time, you need them to understand, look, this is happening and things have changed.
Well, in a way, they tried not to talk about it, in a sense. And that was a big mistake, in my opinion. They tried to kind of pretend that it is normal. That's what happens in an occupation situation, that's what soldiers do, and you need to avoid soldiers. Soldiers are scary. In a way, it's a bit like a lot of parents do to their children here, maybe in Malaysia or somewhere else in the world, where they kind of scare their children with the police. You know, they say, if you do something naughty, I'll get the police for you. A lot of parents, I know a lot of parents who do that. And in a way, yeah, the same in Gaza. It was that sort of like you're told to avoid the soldiers, you're told to avoid the occupation. This is what happens. It's a conclusion, in a sense. So they avoided talking about it. And in my opinion, it was worse, because we didn't sort of understand the background of it, in a sense, and how it all happened until much later, until we grew up and we went to school.
Overall, would you describe your childhood as happy despite all this madness?
Yes, of course. I mean, the Irish have a really good saying. They say hard times are the best of times, because then comedy does very well and becomes humorous somehow. The things that you remember are the good times, the good old times, as they say. Some small memories, some human touches, all of these things, they stick in your mind. So it was.
You've also written a lot about your mother, saying she was the one who held the family together during these times. How did your mother help your family cope?
Well, my mother and a lot of Palestinian mothers as well, they have to be strong. They have to hold the family together, because very often the men are more subject to abuse and more subject to being arrested by the soldiers and more subject to being sent away, etc. And therefore, a lot of the mothers in Palestine, they try to take on the role of the father as well as the mother. And they're very open-minded and very strong in their faith, in their hopefulness that the situation will change and that peace will come at some point. So that's actually the main thing, that the hopefulness, the hopeful messages that she gave us, that things will change and things will become better. She hasn't been right, unfortunately, but that's where we are.
You also wrote that the relationship between mother and son is sacred in your culture, which is, I think, a very beautiful sentiment. Could you share that with everyone?
Yes, I mean, it's an Islamic thing, it's an Arabic thing, it's a universal thing, of course, that this relationship between the son and the mother is very sacred. Of course, Freud would disagree with that and would go into the Oedipus complex and all that, but we're not going to go there. For me, and from my culture and background, you know, this, we say in the Quran, we say that heaven is underneath the feet of mothers, and that's because of the way they work so hard, in the way they dedicate their life, the way they are so selfless, the way they become, I would like to say angels. It's cheesy, I know, but it is true. It's like that being that has this, that gives you this unconditional love. It's a complete unconditional love. No matter what happens, your mother will still love you because you're part of their flesh. Of course, sometimes this doesn't happen. These things do exist.
And it happened for you.
Yes.
When and why did you move to the United Kingdom? How did that come about for you?
I went back in 2002. I left Gaza in 2002, and I went to study my postgraduate degree in English literature in London. That was the main reason why I left. But also the situation was very difficult in Gaza. The second intifada had started then, and the situation was terrible. There were bombings every day, and it was very unsafe. So I decided to go to London to finish my postgraduate degrees.
Was it easy to leave? I mean, was the process of, you know, getting into the United Kingdom the same as it would be for anybody anywhere? You apply to a school, you get it, you go?
No. Unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. It was very difficult at the time. It took me about 3 months to get a visa, and I had to prove to the British Embassy, well, the British Consulate Office in Gaza at the time, that I was genuinely going to study. And it took a long time to do that. But now it's almost impossible because the border is shut. You can't get in or out. So I haven't seen my family for 2 years now, and they haven't met my new daughter, my 2.5-year-old daughter. So it's far more difficult now, although before the border was a bit easier, but the visa was difficult. Now both the visa and the border are difficult, so it's impossible to go to the UK at the moment. I'm trying to get my mother to visit the UK, and it's really difficult.
Just out of curiosity, do your family still living in Gaza, do they have any intention of leaving permanently? I mean, yes, the borders and the visa are difficult, but if they were to obtain, you know, a way out, would it be for good, like yourself?
No, I don't think so. We've discussed that many times. And in fact, my mother came to visit the UK in 2011, and she said, yeah, she wants to go back. Her life is there. Her friends are there. She's too old. I don't think she would resettle now in a new country. I think the situation is desperate. The situation is very difficult. But in a way, it's home. It's their home. It's a difficult place, but it is home in the end. And so it's lovely. It's beautiful as well. Gaza is beautiful. It's a Mediterranean town, you know. It's got all the golden, sandy beaches, you know, you see on TV. And in fact, because it's uncultivated, in a sense, and undeveloped, so you get some really nice natural beaches in pockets of the Gaza Strip, which are lovely. And my mother has a particular spot that she likes so much. I don't think she will trade it for anywhere else.
What's home is home.
Exactly.
For yourself, though, when you were leaving, was it something that you knew you always wanted to do? I mean, you mentioned the situation was worsening. Was it something that was playing in your head that you wanted to leave?
Yes, in a way. I mean, I was studying English literature in Gaza, so I had that sort of view of wanting to study literature in Europe, particularly in London. I've read a lot about it, and it was very familiar. But also, yeah, there was something that happened. My cousin was killed, one of my first cousins, and we were very close, and things got really bad for me in the sense that I was very depressed. And I wanted to get out of there. It was the only way to kind of move forward, because otherwise my life would have been sort of just stuck on there, just stuck on that particular incident. I wanted a fresh start. I wanted to start again. And I'm glad I did, because now I'm more able to look at it from a different perspective, from a different sort of microscope, from a different glasses, if you like, you know, for the outsider glasses.
Well, you left without any expectation of returning home. How did you cope with that?
Well, I didn't know what was going to happen. You know, by the, when I left, it was 2002. The Israelis were still controlling the border on Gaza. There was this big fat soldier who sat behind a big massive desk. He was bald, typical soldier, typical, you know, immigration officer. He just looked at me and, you know, just I looked at him and I didn't know whether I wanted to be back or not, whether to see soldiers again, whether to see an occupier again. So it was very difficult at the time, but of course I missed the family. I knew I wanted to go back because my family are there, my parents are there. And eventually I went back in 2009 after that.
Prior to leaving for your studies, had you left before?
No, it was my first time. Yeah, I'm trying to remember. No, I didn't. No.
I'm really struggling to understand how you managed to just kind of leave. I think for a lot of people, even traveling for the first time anywhere is daunting. How did you prepare yourself mentally for the fact that you'd be going to a whole other place that you might only have, you know, known really through reading about it?
Yes, well, I didn't. The problem, my biggest mistake was not reading about the weather in London. The weather was just so
shocking.
It was really shocking when I first arrived because I arrived with a T-shirt. I arrived in August, so I arrived in a really thin T-shirt. I didn't even have a jacket or a waterproof. And the moment I stepped out of the airport, I wanted to smoke a cigarette outside, and it was just pouring down with rain. It was the coldest day ever. I was so tempted to turn back to the airport and just say, take me somewhere else. But of course, I was young, I was a student, I was ready for an adventure, and that was my adventure.
I'm speaking today with Ahmed Masood, writer, director and academic. We're talking about how to humanize the Palestinian conflict for a global audience. We've been talking about Ahmed's background, what brought him to the United Kingdom. Up next, we'll be covering his work and the current situation in Palestine. You are listening today to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. In the studio with me, Ahmed Masood, writer, director and academic. We're talking about the Palestinian conflict, specifically how to humanize it for a global audience. So as we left you, you're in the United Kingdom. Right now, though, how would you describe the current situation in Palestine?
It's a very difficult situation because although it remains the same in terms of the political reality and the economic reality, I think the difference here is that there is a lack of hope that never existed before, particularly after the Israeli war on Gaza in July 2014, which almost destroyed any hope for most Palestinians, both in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. What is happening at the moment is Gaza is being almost buried alive. Nothing comes in or out. Well, some stuff come in and out, but with very difficulties. And also the borders are shut. So it's a big prison, a big open-air prison. I haven't been able to see my family. My family haven't been able to see me. I don't have hope to see them this year or maybe the year after. I can't even plan my holidays. I can't even plan, you know, my children's summer holidays to go and spend time with their grandparents as any parent would like to plan. And yet at the same time in the West Bank, you have a situation where the settlements are growing and growing and growing, grabbing the land, and it's becoming more difficult to live in the West Bank. So the whole idea of the one-state solution is becoming increasingly difficult to achieve. So that hope that once existed back in the 90s when Arafat and Rabin signed the Oslo Agreement and talked about a two-state solution is almost gone. Well, actually, it's definitely gone from Palestinians. So it's quite depressing. That's the difference. That's the reality. So you asked me about what the situation is like. So people don't know what to expect. They're just living in oblivion at the moment, which is a shame, really. Yeah. And I think it hurts. For me, it hurts personally to see my people like that.
You haven't seen your family in a while. How have you been keeping in touch?
Mostly by phone. Text messages, all the social media when there is electricity, Facebook, Twitter, and WhatsApp and Viber and all these things. There's so many of these things that I can't keep up myself. But I think what the main problem is that the lack of electricity. So very often they don't have connection, their phones don't have batteries, etc. So I have to find the right time when I can call them and when the electricity is there. And that could be 2 a.m. or 3 a.m, which is very annoying, I have to say, you know, when you get a call at 3 a.m. from your brother just because the electricity
that's
is there.
That's when he can.
Yeah, that's when he can. I'm like, okay, dude.
This is how I live now.
Yeah.
I saw also that you took your son to Palestine, and you talked earlier about your parents kind of not being able to fully explain the conflict to you at the time, just saying, okay, you know, this is how it is. Bringing your son back with this heritage, how did you explain what's happening to him, especially because he doesn't live there, so he's not living it day to day?
Yes, that was one of the most difficult things I had to do, actually. I took him back in 2012 and 2013 as well. So twice. He's been to Gaza twice. He is half English, half Palestinian. My wife is English. And in fact, a quarter or a third American as well, because his grandmother is American. So when we went there, I mean, he loved it. He absolutely loved it because, again, back to that holiday destination thing, the sun, the weather was sunny, it was warm, it was raining in the UK. That contrast was amazing to him. The food was brilliant. You know, the family gave him so much attention, lots of chocolates and sweets, and he was the king of the house.
Nobody he was spoiled.
He was spoiled completely. But it was very difficult for the first time. Well, first to start with, when we got to the border and we just had to wait, you know. The border was open, but we had to wait by the Egyptians. We were just waiting. And he was trying to understand why we were waiting. And, of course, he was 3 years old then. And he just had so many books and games and portable DVD player for him to play movies. But there was an end to that, you know? And he was just getting agitated and agitated. You know, he wanted to go, and he couldn't understand why. And even as a three-year-old, believe me, he did ask why we were waiting many and many times. And then later on, 2014, he was 4.5 years old when I took him, and there were a couple of incidents when the electricity went out. And he was trying to understand why that happened. And I was trying to explain to him about the shortage of fuel, that Israel doesn't allow us to have fuel coming in through Egypt, etc. And then there were a couple of bombings from the air, and that scared him completely. That really scared him a lot. So trying to explain that to him as well. So it started back to the basics of the situation. And of course, living in London has changed me completely, because I engage with my child a lot. Not that we don't do in Palestine, of course we do, but it's in a different way. You explain things differently. And I wanted to explain things to him, but I'm not sure whether he still gets it or not. But at the same time, I don't want to drill it in him. I want him to see it for himself. I don't want him, like, there is no need to explain stuff. He will soon find out. So now, for example, he's asking me to go back to Gaza, and I'm saying we can't because the border is shut. I don't need to explain anymore. He will find out later why is it shut and stuff like that. So it's better for him to go on a learning journey by himself rather than me brainwashing him in a way. And that works for everything, from my perspective, the political situation, the religious situation, everything, you know. I think it's better for children to kind of find their own way rather than to be indoctrinated.
Not to compare your three-year-old son to Londoners as a whole, but when you were talking about having to explain the situation, starting from the basics, saying like, okay, well, this is why this is happening. I'm also wondering whether you had to do that often in general, you know, when you meet people, when people say, oh, okay, are you from here? Where are you from? And
yeah,
then, you know,
yeah,
you start talking about it. How often did you find yourself feeling in the position of trying to explain your country?
A lot, very often, with work colleagues, with friends, people on the street, going to a bar, going anywhere, really, you know. What happens normally is that people see you as the guilty one for some reason, because of all this media, how do I say it, that sort of propaganda that the media puts in. And of course, because of the ISIS problem at the moment, the awful ISIS problem, and all these sort of other factors, this sort of, the media packages you together somehow. You become that person, that sort of Muslim, if you like, in quotes in here. And the first thing for me is to try and differentiate myself from all of that, because in a way, the Palestinian problem is about human rights rather than about any religion or political situation. It's about human rights. It's about a set of people who are asking for their basic human rights, and these can be access to water, electricity, food, travel, all the stuff that we all have anywhere in the world. So that's the first thing for me. And then going back to basics, going back to the British Empire and how, you know, actually the idea of establishing a state for Israel in Palestine started back in the 19th century. It had nothing to do with what was going on in Europe in the 40s and in the 30s. In fact, the Balfour Declarations, it was in 1917, way before that, when Britain promised Israel or the Jewish lobby to have a state for Israel in Palestine. So kind of going to these basics and going through them and then looking at some of the dates. So a lot of the Jewish immigration into Palestine started before started in the 20s, well before any sort of concentration camps or any stuff that were happening in Europe at the time. So I try to remind people of these facts and figures so they know where I stand. It's about human rights. That's what I always say. Israel is like the US, and Australia is a colonial project, you know, started as a colonial project. So there's no reason or no need to kind of put it as something else. That's what it is, really, you know.
One issue that can come up when you're trying to explain these things, I assume, these issues, is that people feel distant when things are distant. You know, when it's far away, if it's not top of mind, you're just like, well, okay, you know, it's different for you. You're from there. You have family there. There are very direct roots. But for people for whom it's just another place somewhere where people are fighting, you know, it's a hard thing to grasp. How do you convey the idea that humanity shares such problems? How do you humanize these stories and these issues?
It's a very good question, and it's one that I keep thinking about all the time. But for me, the political change and the political situation is very much like climate change in itself. If it affects one area, it's going to affect us all in some part of the world, regardless of where this is happening. This is a global world that we're living in. It's not the old sort of three continent world that we used to live before. It's a homogeneous global world that has access through communication, etc., etc. So whatever happens in one area will affect us. And for example, you see the conflict in Syria, for example, and the reverberations of that and what happened in other parts of the world as well, in France and other parts. So we need to be aware of this, that actually because it's happening there doesn't mean that it doesn't concern me. I think it does. The other thing is, I think it was Nelson Mandela who said we cannot be completely free without the freedom of the Palestinians, because it's a human rights issue. And I was talking to a friend called a South African poet called Ethel Williams, and he was talking about the fact that actually for him apartheid never finished because it still exists somewhere else, and it just moved from here to there. And that is important to actually say to people, that if you've lived through occupation, if you've lived through colonialism, you know what we're going through. And the fact that you're not going through it right now doesn't mean that it doesn't exist or it's gone away. In fact, we should all be united in fighting it and making sure it doesn't happen to other people anywhere.
And part of how you're expressing this is through creative pursuits. Could you tell me about the theatre and dance group Al Zaytouna, which you founded?
Yes. So we've talked a lot about politics, but actually, I don't actually normally talk about politics. I talk about literature and writing.
I think
and
this might
dancing.
Be the burden of being a global Palestinian.
Yeah, exactly. That's the burden. I have to talk politics all the time. No, I am a writer and a dancer. So I dance Debka. And in 2005, I was in London and I was doing my PhD studies, and I was an international student then with very expensive fees. So I decided to do a fundraising party. And to do that, I wanted to showcase our traditional cultural heritage, the Debka dance. And so I trained some of my friends and told them, well, do you want to perform? And we just made up a dance and we made up a choreography. And it was all downhill from then. It went downhill. People loved it. They the dance. They found the dance energetic. To describe it to your audience, I think, imagine a very choreographed Irish river dance in a way, but with a Middle Eastern Dutch and Middle Eastern music and rhythm. That's what it is. It's very stompy, it's very jumpy, and it's a dance that has a bit of attitude to it in a way, you know, which I love. But for about 10 years, I've been the artistic director of Alzaytuna. I am not now anymore, and I have moved on to do other stuff, but it's still going, and I'm very proud of that, of course. And we've also tried to contemporize the dance itself, so we do a lot of contemporary dance with it, and so the last production we did was an adaptation of Shakespeare's Henry V, which was very ambitious. So doing it through dance and also set in Palestine. So, yeah, which was a bit strange.
You also write your debut novel, Vanished, is set to take readers deep into Gazan society from the perspective of a boy growing up under the brutal Israeli occupation and in the years following the Oslo Accords. What transpires in the book exactly? What message were you hoping to put across?
Right, the book, yes, the novel Vanished. It's called Vanished, The Mysterious Disappearance of Mustafa Awda. I didn't have a message really to put to the audience, and I think writers shouldn't generally. I think it's up to the readers to find out what is in the book. But the main thing here, what I wanted to do with writing that book is to take the audience on a journey to the Gaza Strip. It's very difficult to go as a non-Palestinian, and as a Palestinian, of course, as we just said. So I wanted to take them there with me on a journey. So almost being on a plane and just going there to Gaza, go to the beach, go to the refugee camps, go to have some food, go to smell the places and everything. It's a novel, it's a fiction. And I wanted the audience to stay there for a while in the Gaza. So I took them through the whole period from 1981 to 2011, through the story of a young boy looking for his missing father. Now, the novel is not at all about politics, although we've talked a lot of politics, but it's not at all about politics. It's a human story about a boy looking for his father. And as he finds out what happened, there is a shocking truth in there, and it's almost like the truth will torment you or set you free. And that's really the essence of the book. It's a mystery thriller. The boy, Omar, asks his mother and his uncle and his neighbor about what happened to his father, and he's always getting the same answer, identical, that by the age of 8, he realizes this doesn't make sense, you know, this is exactly identical. So he goes by himself trying to find out what happened, and his first point of call is the Israeli military governor, who's the head of the military there, and he goes into the El Merkez, which is the police or the military station, which is almost like a fortress. A little boy knocking on the door trying to find out about his father. I'll leave it there because I'm not going to say anymore, because if I do...
Spoilers.
It will spoil it. So, yeah. But I wanted the novel to be a complete human story. Even the cover itself has no picture of Palestine or Gaza or anything. I didn't want a picture of... destroyed buildings and sadness and things like that. Nor I wanted like a beautiful orientalist image of the Middle East and Palestine and all that. I didn't want all of that. It's just the cover is just a bright yellow cover with shades on it, which are very significant to the story, but it's very general. It can be anywhere. That's what I'm trying to say. It can be a story that is set in Palestine or in Gaza, because in the end, it's about how humans deal with these difficulties. My father was gone. I was too young to understand why, and nobody was able to explain it to me, not even my mother. When I asked, she would always give me a sad smile, unlike her usual watermelon grin. I hated it when she did that. It frightened me. There was danger in that smile, which I could not understand, a hidden story that I was desperate to uncover. But she never told me, despite my desperate attempts to make her talk. Perhaps this is what pushed me to proclaim myself the youngest detective in the Jabalia camp at the age of 8. I learned not to talk about my father. Sometimes I missed him so much it hurt, almost as if I had nails running through my heart. However hard my mum tried to make it better for me, there was a hole in the middle of the family where Dad should have been. An empty space whenever we sat down to eat. A place that couldn't be filled by anyone else. Everybody had a father, except me, and it hurt. But nobody wanted to know. No one listened when I tried to explain how much I missed him. But for one last time, I wanted to hear the scripted story from her, so I could take it from there. Although I was 8 years of age, There was so much destruction around me, it forced me to grow up much faster. Or maybe I believe I did. One February morning in 1982, 7 months after I was born, Mother woke up and found our front door unlocked. A warm, small cup of sage tea perfuming the salty air. It was still dark outside, which made the house look even smaller. Realizing there had been a power cut, she searched for a candle and lit it. She opened the front door and looked around the narrow alley with patriotic graffiti on its walls. Sometimes Israeli soldiers forced the men in the Jabalia camp to come out in the middle of the night to clean off the graffiti and the anti-occupation slogans painted on the outside walls by Palestinian freedom fighters. Everyone in the camp had to have gallons of white spirit and several brushes stored in their houses to be prepared for such occasions, as they never knew when the masked men would come to paint it or when the Israeli soldiers would take notice and order its removals. During the last 3 years of their marriage, Mother would often watch Father erase from the walls of the camp a white pigeon stuck behind prison bars and carrying an olive twig in its beak, or the Palestinian flag with its red triangle at the top and black, white, and green strips coming out of it.
What's the difference between trying to kind of inform people, bring people to Gaza in this way, compared to what we've been doing, you know, where we've been kind of talking about these very specific issues, talking about very specific moments? What value does storytelling and art kind of bring to the whole pursuit?
I think the value really is it gives the reader, the audience, the ability to imagine and the ability to judge for themselves. You're not being brainwashed. You're not being presented with a lot of information which you can Google and find out by yourself. Or you're not reading an academic book, really. You can do that, of course. They're all available. The power of literature and arts generally is that it gives you, it equips you with imagination to see for yourself and to judge for yourself. And that could be in this direction or that direction, but it doesn't matter. It means that you've given yourself the time to try it and judge it. You know, when you read a book, you're investing some time, you know, and that time is valuable to all of us in this busy life, you know. But you've already made a conscious decision. I want to learn more about this. I want to read this. This sounds interesting. This is something that appeals to me. And therefore, you're giving it the time. And it gives you that imagination and that freedom, really.
Earlier, you spoke about how you feel like you get lumped in, you know, in some ways to all the, and in general, all Palestinians get kind of lumped in into this coverage of Gaza and ISIS. And, you know, it's all just kind of rolled together into this weird mishmash. When you present your work, what barriers are there? Do people have a certain attitude coming in, or are they, do you find them reasonably open-minded?
Mixture of, really. It depends whom I'm talking to and where, whether to which region and what's happening on the news, whether people have had their coffee or not, you know. It all depends, really. Unfortunately, we are all full of stereotypes. And I'm an advocate of trying to change that, both on the personal level and in the society level. We're getting to be more tolerant. We're learning more. But in some specific issues, with the case of Palestine and how it's all packaged together, I think within the younger generation in the UK, people are far more understanding because they're able to find out information for themselves. They can use the social media, they can use the blogging, etc. There is more access to information. Some of the older generation as well who've been to the Middle East, who've been to Palestine, who've even served in the army there, they know it. They know the culture and they know the people. They know the people as people. It's that sort of generation in the middle where they've been brainwashed for a while by the media, and it's sort of like it's getting worse in other parts of the world and it's all getting together, and then a shooting happens in Paris and they think every Palestinian is like that, or every Syrian is like this, or every Muslim is like this, which is ridiculous, you know. So it depends, really, yeah.
Earlier you spoke about also having a different set of lenses to look at Palestine after leaving, you know, gaining some distance, gaining some different context. You were able to see things differently. Now that you're looking at it, not just through the lens of distance, but also through the lens of art, you know, and creativity, have you found, you know, how do you view your homeland differently?
It's a source of inspiration, really. It's a source of creativity. It's a source of giving me strengths and giving me reason to do these things and to be able to write and do theater. I'm more able to experiment differently because I'm outside. I can do things. I can try different ideas. I don't have to offend anybody by doing this. So, for example, the last play I did a play in London at Amnesty, which was called The Shroud Maker, which was about an old woman who was selling shrouds for the dead. You know, in the Muslim culture, we cover the dead with white material only. So this woman, she's 8 years old, she lives in Gaza, and she sells shrouds. So the more war and dead people, the better for her, because she makes more money. You know, so it's that sort of comedy aspect of it. It's the black comedy aspect of it. And the woman character was also played by a man in London, you know. But it worked, because I was able to experiment. I was able to try new ideas. It was very critical. It was very comedy. And the audience found it really daring, and it pushed boundaries a bit. So I think being away and looking at the situation and looking at Palestine through the creative lens, as you said, gives me the ability to be creative and to experiment with new ideas, but also it gives me a lot of inspiration that I'm proud of.
You also take your work around the world now. How has the reception been? You know, how do you think it helps to foster understanding?
Yes, absolutely. I'm trying to get to as many people as possible, hence I'm being here. Thank you for having me here. I think it's amazing to see the different reactions, to see how people respond to it, what level of understanding sort of exists. So in Malaysia, there's a lot of understanding, of course, and there's a lot of support. But I feel like we need to kind of take that on a different level now. There is a lot of things happening. There is the BDS movement that needs to grow in this country as well. And also, just to kind of talk about this BDS or the cultural boycott, if we talk about the cultural boycott, as a writer, I've been invited to speak in Palestine as part of the PALFEST, which is the Palestinian Literature Festival, Festival of Literature, sorry. And they want me to write, to talk about the book and do workshops, etc. But the festival is set in the West Bank, not in Gaza. And although I'm British, I have a British nationality, I can't go to the West Bank because I'm from Gaza. So I need special permission to go to the West Bank, which is apartheid, really, you know. So I'm trying to apply for permission now from the Israeli authorities to allow me to go into the West Bank so I can read from my book. You see, the problem here is that most Israeli artists and writers and cultural practitioners, they're free to go anywhere. But us, we're restricted because of what we do and what we talk about. And
where you were born, really.
And where I was born. That's the only reason. It doesn't matter. And even though, as I said, I have the British passport, it's very difficult to go there. And in fact, it's even worse because my wife, who's white, half British, half American, blonde and all that, she can go to Palestine any minute. I can't go to the West Bank because I'm from Gaza. It gets even worse. My son, who is half British, half Palestinian, or half Palestinian, or a third Palestinian, a third British, third American, can't even go to the West Bank, but his mother can, because my son has the same serial ID number as I do, the Palestinian one. So really, it's about, it's apartheid. It's about where you come from, where you're born, nothing to do with who you are and, you know, your personal sort of attire.
With all that, I'm trying to keep all the different countries we're talking about in my head, but what brought you to Malaysia and what did you get up to during your stay here?
I've come in for a completely different reason. I work for a university in the UK and we have some work here to do with other institutions in KL, which has been very fruitful and amazing, really. So that's why I came, and I've got some free time and I thought, yeah, I'll do some of my book reading as well.
What role do you think art plays in breaking misconceptions about Islam for people who don't grow up in such a similarly multicultural background?
I think one of the things I've been really happy to see here in Malaysia, and especially KL, I was really impressed to see how tolerant it is and how moderate it is and how diverse and multicultural. And I think it's a really good example that we need to show to the world that you can do anything you like. You could have a mosque next and there is a bar and there is somebody covering their head and there is somebody not. And that is very important. That's the essence of our culture and the essence of our religion, is in the sense that it is about, it's about tolerance, really. And I'm not the most religious person in the world, but I think one of the main things that in Islam that it says that you have your religion and I have mine. And I think that's a key message in there in the Quran. It says that you can do what you like and I can do what I like, basically. That's what it is. So try not to force it on me. This is where things go wrong. That's when people try to force their beliefs, what they have in their mind, onto other people, and then all the other problems start. So I think in Malaysia, and in answer to your question, I think if we can sort of find that model, if we can show that model to the world, it's a really great and nice, amazing contrast to what people see in Syria and this awful, awful organization called whatever it's called, ISIS. So it's nice to see that contrast, which will in turn help other parts of that in Palestine, for example, so people start to see that, okay, so there are other models, there are other places as well.
Moving forward, so dance and theatre and books and education, what future projects do you have in your pipeline?
At the moment, I'm writing another novel, and I've set myself a very difficult task, which is that it's not going to have any political thing at all whatsoever. So Vanished doesn't, but it's got a little tiny bit. But this one will not have anything. So it's a crime fiction. It's a murder story set in Gaza. And I'm creating a new detective character, a bit like Poirot or Sherlock Holmes, something like that, set in Gaza, a Palestinian Sherlock Holmes or Poirot. That's my task. And I'm halfway through that. I'm also working on another play on the refugee crisis and how the West is dealing with it. And there are a couple of plays that I wrote before, with the one, The Shroudmaker, I talked about. And also I wrote another play on the Syrian conflict called Wala, or Loyalty, that I would like to restage again, either in London or other parts of the world.
To find out more about Ahmed, you can visit ahmedmassoud.co.uk. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I've been speaking with Ahmed Massoud, writer, director and academic. We've been talking about the Palestinian conflict and how to humanize it for a global audience in the form of art and creativity. You've been listening today to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
She was 24 years old in 1979, and although 6 years younger than him, she was still considered to be too old for marriage by Gaza's standards. Most girls in the late 70s got married at 19 and no older. People talked about mother being too arrogantly beautiful and too fussy in choosing a husband. She was pale-skinned and tall, with thick, straight black hair and wide blue eyes. When my grandfather took my father to ask for her hand in marriage, her response was, "He's the one I have been waiting for." They were then engaged for a year, which added to her already damaged reputation. But mother didn't care. She was madly in love with father and could have easily been engaged to him forever, enjoying the journeys my father took her on, the places they visited together. The 45-minute drive from Jabalia to Khan Yunis in the south always depressed her, and as she leaned her head on the passenger window of father's old 1952 rusty Mercedes, she wished that it could break down so that they could take a walk out in the country, gazing at the olive groves that stretched between Al-Nusayrat, Deir al-Balah and Khan Yunis. She had a favorite spot that she used to go to as a teenager when she ran away from school, just after the turning from the Salah al-Din main road, which runs through the entire Gaza Strip, towards Deir al-Balah. In the early 70s, as a girl, she would climb a small sandy hill that always had litter at the bottom of it and roll cigarettes with a couple of schoolmates. They would stay there until an hour before school finished, giving themselves enough time to return home without any of their fathers suspecting anything. They would laugh and tease each other and gaze at the vast sea in the distance, seeing Israeli gunboats floating on the water. Sometimes Israeli military jeeps would stop and search them, asking for ID cards. They would beg not to be arrested so that their families wouldn't find out what they had been up to. Mother was not that scared. She often wanted to be arrested, challenging the soldiers to do so, to the dismay of her mates, who would beg her to be quiet. Sometimes the soldiers would just sit with them and smoke cigarettes too. After all, they were all only teenagers.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.